This evening, as we continue in our It's Time study, this is session 6. We have 2 more to go. Remember, next week, since it's Mother's Day, we will not have an evening session. And just kind of in thinking off in the future, want us to kind of jot down your ideas and your thoughts about our visitation / outreach program. We want to have some more conversations in the near future about what that should look like or what that might look like. Also, we want to go ahead and kind of warn you or tell you that off in the not too distant future, we will probably, our next study very well may be an introduction to basic Christian doctrine and start this summer. I mean, why do we believe what we believe and how did it get to that point? Where do these doctrines come from and how did they develop? And we are at least currently talking about, if we do that, kind of a heads up, kind of be a little less formal, to move over on Sunday evenings into the Morgan Building, have the table set up so you can kind of spread your Bibles and notebooks out and write and that kind of thing. We can still put that on CD and on the website. The downside is, or the upside, I guess, whichever way you want to look at, depending on who's standing up front. The downside or the upside is that there will not be video, DVD, it'll just be audio. But we're looking at that as well. This evening, I hope that we will find ourselves led to think about and pray that God will illumine our hearts and our minds, not only with a passion for what we talked about last week, the Great Commission, but a passion for doing compassion and for doing justice and mercy. And so tonight we want to talk about it's time to do justice and mercy. And we begin by looking at Micah 6:8, what God requires, and could probably start that, and many, if not most of you, maybe even all of you, could complete it. But He has shown you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God? Now, it's interesting to note, He answers the question that is raised, what is good? And He's saying that God has shown us just what is good, and what is good is what God requires. And those things that God require are for us to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with God. To do justice. We're going to talk in a few minutes just what is justice and look at some dictionary definitions of justice as well as biblical ideas of justice. What is kindness? What is it to walk humbly with God? Those are some of the issues with which we deal. But that is what is good for us to do those things in our lives. Notice, to do justice, to love kindness. And these verbs are in what form, English folks? Active, but also starts with an I. Isn't this the infinitive? And to walk. So we've got to do, to love, to walk. These are active verbs. Once again, as we said this morning, these are not optionals. It's not passive. It's not sit back and check it off if you want to. This is a requirement. These are things that if we indeed are children of God, and if we are Christ followers, and if we indeed seek to be a part of God's grace to the world, there is not a choice. These are action verbs. So what is justice? If you go to the dictionary, you'll find some of these. First of all, the first one, A, the maintenance or administration of what is just, especially by the impartial adjustment of conflicting claims or the assignment of merited rewards or punishment. In other words, impartial judgment on what is just and fair. What is the reward or what is the punishment? It's justice according to law. B, to judge. That's in purple, by the way. C, the administration of the law, especially the establishment or determination of rights according to the rules of law or equity. So we're talking, and that's probably what we first think about when we think about justice, right? Is the law. Doing things according to law. We have rules and regulations, and you break those, justice. Whether that justice is giving you good or whether that justice is punishment. It is justice. 2A, the quality of being just, impartial, or fair. Just, impartial, or fair. The principle or ideal of just dealing or right action. Conformity to this principle or ideal. And the purple word is righteousness. Righteousness. Righteousness, we think about righteous indignation, etc. But righteousness actually indicates a right relationship, a proper relationship. So it's treating people fairly and justly, doing what is right based on a proper relationship with them and with God. And C, the quality of conforming to the law or conformity to truth, fact, or reason. Justice. So there are all kinds of dictionary definitions of justice. The story told about the woman who went to sit for a series of photographs. And she kept fluffing her hair and dealing with her clothes and getting them just right. And finally she sat down and she was really being a pain to the photographer. And she said, "Now, whatever you do, I want you to make sure that this picture does me justice." And he looked at her and said, "Lady, you don't need justice, you need mercy." But what does justice really mean? What does justice really mean? One of the definitions while ago from the dictionary says righteousness. Justice means, from a biblical perspective, the word for justice means, first of all, to be concerned with doing what is right. To be concerned with doing what is right, both personally and socially, to do what is right, what is correct. Secondly, biblical ideas of justice mean to treat persons justly and fairly. Not to be too harsh, but to be fair with persons. Justice also means not being judgmental. There's a difference in justice and judging based on a particular prescribed set of criterion. And being judgmental towards others. Generally, when we're judgmental, towards somebody, it's what is the standard that we are using by which to be judgmental? Carrie? Ourselves. That's right. Ourselves. Not necessarily, or a particular idea we have out here to which we think we measure up, and somebody else doesn't. Usually it's kind of a straw man that we put out there by which to judge other people, being judgmental. And oftentimes when we're judgmental, we're generally rather harsh and not fair in our judgment. And then seeking personal transformation, which will lead to working for social transformation. In the biblical text, over and over again, especially in the Old Testament, but even in the New, there is this idea that if we're going to truly do justice, then first of all, we must be transformed. And then through that transformation, we treat people fairly and justly to try and transform society. We win society one person at a time, but who does it begin with? The self. Yeah, ourselves. That's right. And these are key ideas in biblical understandings of justice. So what is mercy? Because we said to do justice and mercy. If you go to the dictionary, once again, number one, compassion or forbearance shown, especially to an offender or to one subject to your power. Also, lenient or compassionate treatment, such as they begged for mercy, to be lenient, compassionate. Had a student that was supposed, actually, students were supposed to turn in a project, and had a student not too awfully long ago who did not turn the project in. Said student was coming up on graduation, and all of a sudden, and the project doesn't get dropped. I would drop the lowest test grade, but not the project. And that was said right up front. Suddenly, the student started coming up with all kinds of excuses for why, well, my computer was messed up. Then the next time, well, the printer wouldn't talk to the computer and print it. And then, can I email it to you? Yeah, you can email it as an attachment. Well, for some reason, I couldn't get my email to work and allow me to attach it, and on and on. And ultimately got a memo from his parents that he had been on some medications, and he had had some other issues with a girlfriend and some roommates and all of his professors, and in particular me, because it's religion class. And this was, to quote the mother, this course was to be his saving grace. That I should show great leniency, even though everyone knew that it was a letter grade drop for every class period. Not every day. I was lenient. I said for every class period that it's late. And he was already 7 class periods late in turning it in. They begged for mercy. Be lenient or compassionate? Sorry, not in that instance. But a compassion or forbearance to an offender or to one subject to one's power. Another definition. Imprisonment rather than death imposed for first-degree murder. Sometimes I don't know if that's really being lenient or not, depending on where they're placed. But that is seen, according to the definition, as mercy. You're standing in front of the judge, you deserve death, and the judge says, I'm going to give you imprisonment rather than death. Definition 2A, a blessing that is an act of divine favor or compassion. That is a blessing from God. God shows us mercy. The parable of the scribe and the Pharisee. Or, excuse me, the Pharisee and the tax collector. Parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector in Luke 18. Where the Pharisee stands, Lord, I'm glad, aren't you glad you got me and I'm not so bad like this tax collector over here. And the tax collector, the sinner, wouldn't raise his eyes, but he stood off and he said, Lord, have mercy on me, I'm a sinner. And Jesus said, that one is the one that had his prayer answered. And if you think about divine favor, if we all got the justice that we typically think of, law and retribution, we wouldn't have compassion. But here we find that divine favor from God. A fortunate circumstance. It was mercy that they found her before she froze. Or compassionate treatment of those in distress. And the example given here is works of mercy among the poor. Compassionate treatment of people in times of distress. What about biblical ideas of mercy? If you were to go and look both at Hebrew words and Greek words for mercy, you would find among the definitions given being tenderhearted, being generous, giving, and forgiving within the ideas of mercy. But then again, that shouldn't surprise us if we really think about God's mercy for us. Unfortunately, a lot of folks will accept God's mercy for them without showing mercy for others. And Jesus told parables about that. told a parable about one person who owed the king a great sum of money and went and begged and pleaded not to take his life, not to take his home, not to take his property, not to do anything to his family. And the king forgave this very large debt that the man owed to him. And then the man turned around and went out, and as he was walking down the street, he saw someone that owed him just a little bit. And he started demanding the guy give it to him. And when this guy begged for mercy, he had him thrown in prison. And then when the king found out, the king came back and changed his mind. But if we're going to look for that kind of tenderheartedness and forgiveness from God, then we as God's followers, as Christ followers, are also called upon to give generously, to forgive generously, to be tenderhearted. Also in the ideas, biblical ideas of mercy, getting and giving not what we deserve, but what we need. Mercy. Not what we deserve, but that which we need. And the idea here is that which we need to be better. It's not, I need the winning lottery ticket. Or I need Ed McMahon to ring my doorbell. Of course, these days I don't know what you'd want Ed McMahon ringing your doorbell. Instead of giving you something, he'd be wanting something. But getting and giving, not what we deserve, but what we need. And notice, it's not just getting what we deserve and what we need, but also giving to others what is needed. Not giving them what they deserve, but what they need. All of these ideas of justice and mercy and being fair have to do with two relationships. And I guess if my arm was long enough, could turn and, you know, you'd have to do with two relationships. Vertical, that is relationship with God. Horizontal, relationship with others. And it could almost, if I was blacked out from here down, I could say that's a big L. And that L stands for love. But it all has to do with vertical relationships and then horizontal relationships. And without being a complete person, we can't be a complete person or truly show that same compassionate love and that merciful love that we get from God if we don't reciprocate and show it to others as well. If we don't let it flow through us and out to somebody else. We are not a whole person, and we can't truly have that passion for the good news, the gospel, the Great Commission, and do it justice if we don't have a proper relationship with God and B, a corresponding relationship with others. One can have as great a relationship as they think they might have with God and then not relate well with justice and mercy and passion and compassion to others, and it doesn't do you a bit of good. You're not a complete person. You might try and try and try to do all of these things for people out here without that relationship with God. It's not as meaningful and doesn't make as big a difference. Another idea of mercy is showing compassion and passion both. And it's passion for compassion, which comes from God's mercy for us shown in Christ. So questions. First question is, how does our church practice justice and mercy? How do we practice justice and mercy? Okay, we've got a lot of committees in place to help people. And that's a good place to start. But we've got the committees in place. If they don't do, then it's just a committee. But we do have committees that look out for that and that do some things. Other ways our church practices justice and mercy. Praying for each other. But not just for each other. Praying for others outside as well. You all bring food and other items to share, whether it's school items that go to help school children or food items that go to Perk or go to Allendale to help out there. Once again, CBF meeting last week, I took almost a whole trunk full of food items and other things for the Allendale ministry. Doing justice and mercy. Treating people fairly. That also includes making sure when somebody comes in the door that's not been here before, or perhaps hadn't darkened it since several Christers ago, you know, Christmas and Easter, that we don't look down on them and point fingers at them and run them off. And we don't just speak to them and then turn and walk away real quickly. But we actually seek to have conversations with them and let them know that they are welcome here and that if they've been here before and it's been a while, that they've been missed. Not because we're keeping count and they got to make up, but because we genuinely are concerned with mercy and compassion and their well-being. And then think, what do we do well? Well, we've talked about a few of those. But think in your mind about other things that maybe we do well. The next question is, who or what is being overlooked? Are there persons that we're overlooking? Are there situations that we're overlooking that we could do more? And what do we need to do better? We might be doing things pretty well in some areas, but what do we need to do better to practice justice and mercy? In fact, Daniel Vestal writes that justice and mercy need to become ways of life for us as Christ followers. First of all, we need to seek to live justice and mercy. Not just to talk about it, but to make it a part of our everyday lifestyle. Which also means that we can't rest on our laurels, because we constantly have to be thinking about how we are living and ways that we can improve and things that perhaps we missed. Selfishness and self-centeredness hinder personal expressions of justice and mercy. If we're selfish, if we're totally self-centered, then we really can't show justice and mercy to others. In order to make justice and mercy ways of life, then we need to change how we view others and how we view ourselves. It's the old Billy Joe Royal song. Down in the boondocks, down in the boondocks, people put me down because that's the side of town I was born in. We can't view others or ourselves as coming from the wrong side of the tracks. We're all on one side of the tracks or another. And we let the tracks divide us. We should seek to find ways to overcome that. To view, we simply have tracks between us. It's not a matter of one is better or worse than the other. And that's a hard thing. Because as human beings, we want to be better and think of ourselves better. And we want to have more. But we need to begin changing how we view others and ourselves. And I will tell you, I don't know about you, but for me, that's a difficult thing. Especially folks who you feel might have wronged you. I have a personal difficulty with someone in our homeowners association who doesn't think the rules apply to them and takes their dogs and lets them go in other people's flower beds and stuff and dares you to say anything, and then they cuss you out in Turkish. Who refuses to pay regime fees. Of course, we keep filing liens, but because they don't believe they should have to live by the rules. And shouldn't have to, even though when they bought there, they were given, you know, all but we don't like where the money goes, therefore we shouldn't. So I have a real difficult time with that person. I have to admit, and I still have a real difficult time with that person. And so it's hard work trying to change my view of that person. But we have something that we're supposed to always be working on. Some examples of mercy. The Good Samaritan. In the parable, Jesus said he showed mercy. What happened with the other guys? Well, hey, the priest walked by on the other side. The Levite walked by on the other side. And the guy in the ditch, they knew. It was just like them. Except for the fact he had been beaten up now, which made him less than them in their eyes. The Samaritan comes along, the guy who was the outcast in the eyes of everyone else, and who probably some time ago, I don't know if you recall or not, but we had a visit from the guy who was beat up and left on the side of the road about a year and a half, 2 years ago. And as he was talking about that experience of being left there and folks that were like him and that perhaps even knew him went on the other side, and somebody went to help him, and he thought the dialect was a little bit different. When he looked up, he was horrified to see he was being touched by a Samaritan, until he realized the Samaritan knew all too well the rejection that he felt. And even with that, instead of holding it against him, he reached out and helped. And Jesus said, and he showed mercy. He lived it out. In order for us to truly make those changes, then hearts must be changed, minds must be changed, and behaviors must be changed. A change of heart means that hatred must be replaced by love. Anger must be replaced by peace. Selfishness must be replaced by grace. And the will to power, that is, to have power and use it, must be replaced by the will to serve. Doing justice and mercy means that... Now, that doesn't mean that we have to forget what those persons did that hurt us so that it doesn't happen again. But what it does mean is that the hatred we feel because we may have been wronged or because they're different from us should be replaced by love. Jesus said, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. And as much as sometimes I'd like to think that he said P-R-E-Y toward those who persecute you, it was not P-R-E-Y to pray upon them because they've hurt you, so now I'm going to get you. But P-R-A-Y to say prayers on their behalf, asking God to bless them and to change them into someone better than even you are. That's tough. At times I really don't want to do that. To replace our anger, our indignation, with a sense of peace and calm, doesn't mean that we have to let it go on. Doesn't mean that we have to say, okay, well, I know it's wrong and it makes me angry and they shouldn't be doing that, but you know, it's their lives, so I guess we'll just let it go. No. But rather than being irritating and confrontational, almost to the point of coming to blows sometimes, that we should be peaceful and filled with and seek peace even with those with whom we're angry. Messiah is called the Prince of Peace in Isaiah chapter 9. Not because he's peaceful and stays out of everybody's way, but because he actively seeks peace, even with those who are different and do not like him. Selfishness, gimme, 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 replaced by grace. I'm going to pray for you and I'm going to share with you. The will to power replaced by the will to serve. Jesus said, you know how among the Gentiles their authorities lord it over them, but in my kingdom it shall not be so. But the first shall be last. And the greatest will be least of all. For the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve. If anyone had the power, it was the Son of Man. But Jesus came to serve. And if we are Christ followers and imitators of Christ, then we are called to do the same. Minds must be changed. You know, most people's thinking is shaped more by pop culture, family, and friends than by Christ. If you really think about it, more of our thinking and the ways we do things, especially in this postmodern / post-Christian world, is shaped by pop culture or what our friends think than it is by Christ. The corporate model, the entertainment model, the bigger is better simply because it's bigger and more flashy model. All of these have not just... We used to say they're starting to creep into the church. They haven't crept into the church. A lot of these have overwhelmed even the church, like a tidal wave. We do, and we talked not too long ago about it a little bit more, but in detail. But unfortunately, oftentimes the church in this era, well, in the last 20 years, 15 to 20 years, has allowed the culture, the society, to set the agenda and to determine how we do things rather than, we've got the success model. Big business, the success model with a CEO, and service tends to go out the window, closeness tends to go out the window, and it's all about dollar signs and noses and toeses. That doesn't mean having people present is not important, because we share this journey and that's how we learn together and journey together and support each other. But if that's the model, then there's a problem. Most people wish to remain comfortably within their own circles and become set in their ways. I mean, it's easier to remain comfortable where we are and with the people we are. Speaking of some of those folks, ran across this narrow-minded mind is already made up. Hard-headed and narrow-minded means your mind's already made up. It's not open. I sometimes talk to students about and others about the fact that you go to the tombs in the Valley of the Kings, and they were filled with all, bless you, they were filled with all kinds of phenomenal treasures. And they were sealed up tight. And all of that good was in there, all that good stuff and all that good air, what happened over the centuries of being sealed up. It went stale. It didn't just go stale, it soured. And there were actually, when some of those tombs were opened back last century, there were actual instances recorded where the first people in got sick and or died because of the noxious air that had gathered in those sealed up tombs. Sealed with all of what could be wondrous and glorious, and yet it was clamped shut. And so what was in there became sour. And I've often said that a closed mind is very much like that. Because no matter what good might go in there, eventually we're so afraid, it gets clamped so tight that not even the breath of God can get in there to open up and give freshness and openness to the treasures of God. But if you pry the mind open a little bit, what would happen? Eventually they'd open those tombs and let them air out. Let the stale stuff come out and the good air flow in. Then they could go in and look at all these treasures of the pharaohs. It's the same thing with the mind. And especially when we think on spiritual things and religious things, if we clamp it down because that's the way it's always been, because we're afraid, it becomes noxious and it doesn't help us or anybody else. I used to tell folks that if I had an image to describe myself or what I do, it would be a crowbar. Because sometimes I try to pry open just a little bit, just to let a little bit of freshness and a little bit of air or a little breeze come in and disturb what's there, so that perhaps we can find something new from God, rather than totally making up our minds to be open, not wide open to anything, but open to the possibilities and carefully look. Also, if we remain comfortable in our own circles and we're hard-headed and narrow-minded, then we're showing a lack of compassion. And the change of mind is difficult and uncomfortable for many of us. But what about Jesus and Paul? Jesus in Matthew 11, 28 and 29 says, "Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke," and I put in parentheses, mantle. Take upon yourself the mantle. We think about followers taking up the mantle of the cause of the direction and of their mentor and the way they did that. "Take my yoke," or "my mantle, upon you and learn from me. For I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls." Jesus' mantle, which we are to carry on, includes being gentle with others, being humble, and that we help others find rest and relief for their restless souls in this world. You know, we think, and rightly so to a degree, when it says, "Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you'll find rest for your souls." And that is a great comfort, because there are times we definitely need that. We feel like we've been to Atlanta far too many times. Right? And you need rest. And you're weary. Even if you've been running around a Coca-Cola plant and CNN. But I'm also talking about other folks who work in Atlanta and here and other places. You know, can you? Oh, that's great. That's great. However, that's not all that it means. Or we read it at funerals. This person has finally gotten their peace. And that is a part of it. But the challenge here is that we will take that mantle or yoke, we will learn from Jesus what it is we are to do. To be gentle and lowly in heart, that is humble, and to help others find rest for their restless souls. That's part of doing justice and mercy. The Apostle Paul writes in Romans 12, 2 and following, "Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds, that you may prove what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable in purpose." And what is that will? "For by the grace given to me, I bid everyone among you not to think of himself more highly than he ought to." And he talks about the gifts that are given to us, let us use them, and then he gives a partial list. If you go there, actually, if we go here, "We are members of one another. We have gifts that differ according to the grace given to us: prophecy in proportion to faith, ministry in ministering, the teacher in teaching, the exhorter in exhortation, the giver in generosity," that is, he who contributes in liberality, "the leader in diligence, the compassionate in cheerfulness," or the translation here, "he who does acts of mercy with cheerfulness." And that's in verse 6 through 8. To do acts of mercy with cheerfulness. As a Christ follower, we always should be learning, growing, and changing. Christian discipleship means that we learn, but we are also learning in order to become transformed. We don't just learn one time and that's it. We continue learning so that we can become transformed. It's a process. As we become more Christ-like, both what we think and how we think change. It's not just that what we think changes, but how we think. Doing justice and mercy. And it should affect our behaviors. Culture has the greatest influence on behaviors for many persons. We've talked about that. Oh, if you need to copy, go ahead. Okay. In the fourth to fifth centuries, we had the seven deadly sins. And actually, they were first called seven deadly passions. I've just got to be careful about that word passion, so we call them sins. They were first listed by Evagrius. The first of those was gluttony, an inordinate love of food. You can supersize that meal. Would you like fries with it? How about if we throw on 5,000 more grams of fat. It's fat free. All fat is free. Gluttony, an inordinate love of food. Avarice, or greed. That is the inability to be satisfied with what we have. You ever had somebody say, oh, they're just never satisfied. Doesn't matter what they get, they're just never satisfied. Impurity, that is lust for the body. Depression. And here we're talking about a grief which distorts life so that we can't see the goodness of life. That's what this particular passion was described as. It's a grief, this kind of depression. It is such a grief which distorts the way you see the world that you cannot see anything good about life. Yes, Kerry.
Question on that. I mean, when you talk about that type of level of depression, take a more, say, like clinical depression, that's not necessarily something that a person can control like some of the other symptoms.
Okay, not something that if it's like clinical, it's not something a person can necessarily control like some of the others. And to a point, that is true. But at the same time, part of what was going on in the 4th and 5th centuries was talking about a worldview where nothing was... It would almost be like the Puritans. It was once said of the Puritans that they were the way they were because they were afraid that somewhere, at some time, at some point, somebody was going to have fun, and you weren't supposed to have fun if you were a Christian.
So this would be more like being
possessed,
possession.
Well, I mean, you could go with the idea of possession, but it's also more having an outlook on life to where you can't enjoy life. There's nothing good because you're so afraid that anything you do is going to be the wrong thing. And so what you do is actually depress or suppress any goodness that you can find in life whatsoever. Anger, which is considered the most deadly of the passions or sins. Jesus talked about being angry with your brother and how that anger, if it's allowed to stay inside, then can escalate into insult and then fighting words and physical confrontation. Sloth, that is a boredom or a laziness that makes ordinary life dull. And that kind of laziness or sloth distorts life. Pride, also called vainglory. It's the love of praise and the opposite of humility. Pride goes before the fall. And we need to understand that our behaviors can be complicated and injurious to ourselves and to other people. If we're not careful, we can hurt ourselves and we can hurt others with our behaviors because of the way we view life. Going back to what you were saying about this depressive grief that distorts and can't see any goodness in life, we can end up actually hurting other people and saying injurious things to them or treating them in that kind of fashion because they may see something good in life and they may be joyful and find joy in life and we can't find it, and so we end up creating difficulties because of that. I mean, the Puritans did that. So facts, 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 and I know we're running short on time here. These facts are actually a few years old. Some of them are. The first one's not. The average American family has 3 television sets. Now, I'm not going to ask how many y'all have, but the average American family has 3. We got 4. Yeah. I'll say it evens out. You got 2. Yeah. Part of the reason we got 4 is with kids in the house. And we 2 of ours are so old that I don't even think you could get them repaired. But the average American family has 3 television sets. The average American watches TV at least 5 hours a day. And on Tuesdays and Wednesday nights, probably a lot of those are watching 2 hours each of those nights watching that American Idol thing. Uh-oh. Think about your pets. Half of the pets in the United States are overweight. I'm not talking about your spouse. Your girlfriend or boyfriend or your significant other. Do what? Well, a lot of them are starving. Half the pets in America are overweight. In other words, we have enough affluence to where our pets are overweight. AIDS has killed nearly 6 million children worldwide. Children. Not adults. Americans constitute less than 5% of the world's population, but consume 25% of the world's energy. This is an older fact. I think the percentage is a little bit higher, but not much. It's still pretty close. But in 1997, of the 501 million passenger cars registered in the world, 25% of them were in the United States. That's out of the whole world. A fourth of them were here in the U.S. In 1999, 31 million Americans were hungry on a daily basis, and 12 million of those were children. And those numbers have gone up, especially in the last 6 months. What's that, William? I won't ring it tonight.
Yeah.
Mine's on vibrate. But yeah, computers and cell phones. Yeah, we've got to be in touch. So questions as we end. What can or should our church be doing to make a positive difference in the world beginning in Piedmont? What can or should our families do to make a positive difference in the world beginning in Piedmont? Yeah, we think about, well, the world out there. But we've got it right here. We have folks hungry right here. We have folks living in cars right here. We still do have connections ministry in place. And it's both a matter of reporting those things that you know and then helping out as you can. How can you individually begin to be a more intentional instrument of justice and peace? And what are the implications of that if you decide to? Because it's going to cost. Maybe monetarily, maybe not, but it's going to cost time, effort, worry, prayer, all kinds of things. Are you willing? What are the implications? How can our church become a more intentional instrument of justice and mercy? And how can your group become a more intentional instrument of justice and mercy? The groups in which you operate. And what are the implications for that? If you decide to do that, what are the implications? Daniel Vestal writes, and we close with this, "The gospel is all about change. Personal, social, and even global. God's desire for us is to become people who are passionate about justice and mercy. And that's how the world will change. When we treat people justly and fairly, and with an idea of how God treats us, and when we have a passion for showing mercy." Merciful heavens. Perhaps in showing that mercy, the earth will become more like the heavens. And Christ's kingdom and love and grace will bring the Great Commission even more home to those around us. God bless you. Go in peace. Amen.